This program is released under a Creative Commons license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org. This is Christ the Center, episode 47. Today we speak with Daryl Hart about deconstructing evangelicalism. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I have with me today, around the table, we're all present in the same room, which is a rare occurrence. I have with me Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation, Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. How are you doing, Jeff?
Doing well. How are you, Camden?
Good, good. It's good to have you. We also have with us Nick Batzig, who's interim pastor at Christ the King PCA in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. Hey, Nick.
Hey, Camden.
And our guest this evening, we're pleased to welcome back to our show Dr. Daryl Hart, who's Director of Academic Programs at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. He's also Adjunct Professor of Church History at Westminster Seminary, California. We're pleased to have you, Daryl.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Today we're going to be speaking about Deconstructing Evangelicalism, which is a book Daryl has written. He's written several others, including The Secular Faith, Why Christianity Favors the Separation of Church and State, as well as Defending the Faith, J. Gresham Machen, and the Crisis of Conservative Protestantism in Modern America, which we kind of spoke about in our last episode. If you'd like to, with Daryl, I should say, if you'd like to check on that, you could visit the website and listen to episode 32. But we want to pause and talk about any new books. It's something we haven't done for the last few episodes, since Jeff's been out. But the book man is back, and we have a few books to talk about really quick. What do we need to mention, Jeff?
Well, I must be honest and tell you that my computer was misbehaving for the last several days, so I didn't get an opportunity to do my typical browsing of the web to check on what's new, what's forthcoming, and what is already in the bookstore. But I did have at least one book that I don't remember if we had plugged before or not. We may have, and that is a book called Scripture and Worship, Biblical Interpretation and the Directory for Worship, part of a series called The Westminster Assembly and the Reformed Faith by P&R. And this one is co-written by Richard Muller and Roland Ward. It comes out of a conference back 4 or 5 years ago that Westminster Seminary had celebrating the Westminster Standards. In there are some very fine chapters. We mentioned a couple of episodes back, Dr. Muller had an article on the background to the Covenant of Redemption in the 2007 issue of the Mid-America Journal of Theology. And I mentioned at that point that there was a companion piece that came out of that conference in this book, that the background to the Covenant of Works. So if you're looking for a good discussion of the theological and biblical exegetical background to the Covenant of Works, this is the book.
Excellent.
And Jeff and I were talking about this earlier. I thought it was interesting that Muller mentions the annotations of the divines in one of his articles in there or his lectures, because that's a work that you don't hear about a lot. It's actually not in print. You probably find it on Ebo if schools have subscriptions to that. I know Westminster Seminary does for the students. But the annotations, and Muller makes the point in there that they're sort of a gem mine of historical theological study that's been largely untapped because it hasn't been in print, and they're sort of brief interpretations by a lot of the divines going through the whole of the scripture. But I thought that was very interesting, so I know our listeners would probably like to know that.
Now, what I found interesting in the I have both I have the lecture form on CD as well as the book, is that Dr. Muller makes note of the fact that the scripture proofs in the Westminster Standards are not proof texts. What they're supposed to be are shorthand notations to go and look in the scriptures, but also to tell the listener, the reader, to go look in the annotations or the commentary tradition of the Westminster Divines and the Reformed Scholastics to see how they would treat a particular passage. so that there's a whole exegetical tradition behind each of those proof texts.
Yeah, shorthand, like you're saying, hooks right. to further works. That's good. I've heard that before. Were there any other books that you'd like to mention? Did we have anything else?
I was trying to think if there was anything off the top of my head that I could think of.
Yeah, and if we have any astute listeners out there, you already know that we are well behind on our books since we've recorded a little bit into the future. So the books we're mentioning that have just come out have been out for a little bit for the listener.
When is Gamble's work coming out?
In April.
In April.
Yes, the folks at PNR told me.
Because
April 2012.
No, I believe 2009.
Yes.
That'll be volume one, Whole Counsel of God.
The long-awaited volume one.
Some of the first part of the Counsel of God? Is that?
Some of us have the privilege of seeing it in, pre-publication format.
Well. I'm not one of those somebody, so.
Neither am I. But it doesn't matter because today we're going to be talking about Deconstructing Evangelicalism. This is a book that Dr. Hart wrote a few years ago, and it has been kind of the foundation for many people in the conservative church nowadays on talking about this issue. It's been a tremendous help in forming the thought of several people, and we're very pleased to be able to talk about it today. Now, as we get started, Daryl, maybe I'll ask you this very general, very difficult question. What exactly is an evangelical?
An evangelical is somebody who has a personal relationship with Jesus, and we'll put it that way.
Mm. George Marsden says an evangelical is someone who likes Billy Graham. Someone also says that an evangelical... that a fundamentalist is an evangelical who is mean. There are very few good definitions of evangelicalism because there is so little institutional embodiment of it. There is the National Association of Evangelicals. And I've also been told parenthetically that if you say the word as evangelical, then you are one. If you say evangelical, then you're not one.
Uh-oh, I gotta watch myself.
Interesting.
But
Augustine.
Right. The National Association of Evangelicals does have a 9-point doctrinal standard. So conceivably you could say that is that's some sort of benchmark for being an American evangelical. There is also, and I think one of the criticisms of this book has been that I was only looking at American evangelicalism, and that's true. British evangelicalism is different because of a different ecclesiastical political setting. And Canadian evangelicalism is probably also more like British than evangelicalism in the United States, but still. Usually definitions include conversion experience, dedication to holy living, and certain cardinal doctrines, whether it's inerrancy, fundamentalist 5 points, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it really depends on who's doing it. So it seems to me it's really an arbitrary definition because every single scholar of American religious history sort of has their own definition or has the author or authority that they go to for this definition. So it could be Knoll, it could be David Bevington, it could be whomever. But
it's sort of like Puritan studies, where it's difficult to define exactly. What a Puritan is.
Right.
It's such a broad and slippery term.
Right.
Yeah. Where do you have a question?
I was just going to ask, somewhere in your book you talk about Harold Lindsell wanting to abandon the term. Do you... And you sort of deal with that a little bit. Do you think that's a good thing, or do you think that's impractical?
I think it would be beneficial to give it up. I haven't thought of a good
replacement,
right? Other than conservative Protestant, and that doesn't necessarily get it. Although, since evangelicalism, the way that we know it now. I mean, you could look at three different narratives of evangelicalism. One, you could say evangelicalism started in the 16th century at the Protestant Reformation. And that's when Lutheranism was, they called themselves evangelical because they had recovered the Evangelion. So there's the origins of the word in many respects. And that is then synonymous with being a Protestant. And so that goes all the way down to the 1920s when B.B. Warfield calls himself an evangelical, at the same time that Shaler Matthews, a prominent liberal theologian at the University of Chicago, also calls modernism, he calls it evangelical. So the word really does mean, all the way down to the 1930s, it means just generically Protestant, and that goes all the way back to the Reformation. Another definition, another historical way of looking at it is that it's something that begins in the 18th century with the revivals of the First Great Awakening, when conversion experience and holy living become more prominent. And then a third starting point for evangelicalism really is the 1940s with neo-evangelicalism, where you have these progressive fundamentalists who don't want to be mean and nasty like the fundamentalists or separatists, and they want to have a common cause, and so they call themselves evangelical, and they actually end up owning the name. And it's the liberal Protestants who end up giving up the name evangelical, which is really a quite remarkable thing in the 20th century for a big group of Protestants to give up the name evangelical. But you can give neo-evangelical some credit for sort of branding the name. But that movement has not really panned out as well as many people hoped it would. Fuller Seminary is not necessarily a bastion of the evangelical theology that it once was thought to be or designed to be. Christianity Today certainly has its own afflictions, and those are two of the chief institutions of that movement. Billy Graham is, you know, on the decline, and maybe his best successor is his daughter, which Christianity Today just ran a feature story on, that she's the best preacher of the bunch. And so, you know, I guess women's ordination is a little bit up for grabs among evangelicals, you might say.
Has been for a while. Yeah.
So anyway, it's a very slippery term, and I think it would be better. I think one of the things I argue in the book is that it would be better just to identify ourselves by our denominational or congregational label. So I'm a Presbyterian. I'm an Orthodox Presbyterian. People who like Bill Hybels, they can call themselves Willow Creek. Mm-hmm. People who like Rick Warren, they can call themselves Southern Baptist.
It's more clear.
Yeah. But, I mean, the way the press and so many scholars use the word, I am an evangelical as much as Benny Hinn is an evangelical. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't really help clarify much. In fact, it obscures far more than it clarifies.
When did lowest common denominator evangelicalism start to come about, and why?
Well, in my understanding, I mean, you could argue that the Reformation had various efforts of a lowest common denominator, conceivably because Protestants were politically very vulnerable, and they needed to avoid fighting with each other if they had to fight a common foe in Roman Catholics and Roman Catholic magistrates. So there were various efforts to try to get Protestants and Lutherans together, for instance. But that's not what you're talking about. But still, we can give lowest common denominator or union efforts a bad name, but we can also recognize that there's a laudable side of these as well. I think after the Civil War in the United States, that's when the ecumenical movement really began. I think it was very much fueled by the aftermath of the Civil War, where Protestants realized that they had worked together during the war for a common end, depending on which side of the Mason-Dixon they were on. And so you see a lowest common denominator Christianity or Protestantism emerging then that leads all the way down to the Federal Council of Churches, founded in 1908. That's sort of the social gospel, liberal Protestant version of that. And then the National Association of Evangelicals is founded precisely to counter the Federal Council. So they're going to do an evangelical version of the lowest common denominator. So interestingly, 1942, the NAE has a 9-point doctrinal creed. The Federal Council of Churches has a 1-point doctrinal creed, and that creed is Jesus is Lord. That's all you need to do to be a member of the Federal Council of Churches. So I mean, the impulse behind both of these, though, is to try to get people to come together to work for a common purpose. The National Association of Evangelicals' original magazine was called United for Action, something like that. And so they had the actions they had in mind were evangelism, all sorts of publications, some missions, some evangelism. But also they had a kind of political dimension as well, which is what the Federal Council also had, because that was a social gospel endeavor. And ironically, you could argue that the National Association of Evangelicals sort of spawned the religious right that came along almost 40 yeah. years later. But that's a more complicated set of dots to connect.
Yeah.
Now, I recently finished reading Garth Rozelle's book, The Surprising Work of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that that the lowest common denominator approach is embodied in Harold John Ockeghem, even in his own theology. Or maybe it's brought about by trying to weld Wesleyan and Calvinistic theology together. At least that's how it's portrayed in the book.
Right.
That's how I came away.
Right. I think that would certainly be Rozelle's. I haven't read the book yet. I mean, I've got it. It's one of the things I need to read. But I don't know how representative Ockeghem was. I mean, he was clearly influential because he was the president of first president of the NAE, on the editorial board of CT, also the president of Fuller Seminary. So, I mean, he was clearly a neo-evangelical establishment figure. But the other people in that group, no one else had really studied at Westminster or Princeton. So no one else had the Reform background necessarily that Ockeghem did. And so he had gone to Taylor University as an undergrad, which was a Wesleyan holiness school. So how he put all that together is really a mystery. But the NAE was clearly trying to bring together Calvinists and Arminians, and it's why churches like the OPC and the Christian Reformed Church stayed out of the NAE, because there were Arminians in it. But overwhelmingly, the membership originally, numerically, was Pentecostal and Wesleyan.
Hmm.
And it still is. I mean, Ted Haggard was not exactly a Calvinist then.
How important was Carl F. Henry? Because his name seems to surface anytime a book like your book is written, or any other book analyzing the sociological, you know, impact of evangelicals in the last century. How important is he?
I would say, in my understanding, now there's been much more work done at the dissertation level in the last 10 years on the neo-evangelical movement. And a really good book that's been out now almost 10 years by Joel Carpenter called Revive Us Again, The Reawakening of American Fundamentalism, or something like that, published in 1997 by Oxford University Press. That really is the best book on the neo-evangelical movement. But I think it would be fair to say, even on the basis of that book, that neo-evangelicalism sort of had three important figures. Ockeghem is kind of the organization man of the movement, Billy Graham, the celebrity of the movement, and then Henry, the intellectual of the movement, or the theologian of the movement, even though he was trained sort of as a journalist. And that's what he, I think, often thought of himself as. But clearly, I mean, writing a four-volume work on the doctrine of Scripture, Henry was regarded as their theological high watermark for neo-evangelicalism. So in that sense, he was very important. And he wrote just a ton. He edited a lot. So he was the guy who editors or conference organizers would asked to come and speak or give a talk, and he was productive, so he complied and he produced a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And I have one more question. He was I guess a monumental figure in evangelical theological society. Is that true, in the formation of it, or in the doctrinal standard of it, the inerrancy issue?
I don't know. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but I'm assuming that he was a big player in it. And clearly one of the doctrinal affirmations required of members in ETS is the doctrine of inerrancy. And since Henry spent so much of his life defending the doctrine, I can't imagine his fingerprints weren't on that, mm-hmm. the ETS, which was, I think, was founded about 1956 or so, about the same time that Christianity Today was founded. And he was the original editor, as I understand it, of Christianity Today. Henry was, mm-hmm. and it was, and CT then was intended to be much more of a, more like a journal than a magazine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it had some news, but it was news of churches, mm-hmm. and it's really, it's a later iteration where it became sort of the evangelical version of Time or mm-hmm. Newsweek.
And it had good men. I mean, James Boyce worked under Carl Henry, which
right.
is pretty astonishing. Most people, I don't think, know that there were good men. And they gave Van Til articles, I think, early on.
Right.
So very different than what it became.
Hmm. Now, going back to beginnings of the OPC and the modernist fundamentalist debate that laid some of the theological furniture around at the time, could you connect some of the dots for us and for some of the listeners in what sprung up out of the controversy that Machen was involved in, and why the OPC and other Reformed churches weren't as affected or weren't as involved in the progression of the evangelical church?
If you look at enrollment figures at Princeton Seminary, they spike after Christianity Liberalism comes out in 1923, Machen's probably arguably his most important book. And so you have, I mean, basically the world of higher education and seminary education was bifurcated between the mainline seminaries, which were all liberal by the 1920s, except Princeton. And then evangelicals, again, using the word anachronistically, because evangelical was just at the time meant Protestant. So the proto-evangelicals or the fundamentalists were going to Bible colleges and Bible schools, and that was a very different animal from seminary education, where these were basically lay schools or schools for the laity to get them out to become evangelists, urban work, and the like. So Princeton was the only place to go if you were a smart conservative or fundamentalist, and so Princeton begins to attract a lot of people who aren't Presbyterian.
Okay.
And that continues with Westminster because of Machen's reputation then after 1929. And so Westminster also attracts a number of people who aren't Reformed. And so there's an expectation that Westminster and Machen are going to go in the same trajectory as what emerges in the 1940s with the National Association of Evangelicals and what Akinge is doing, because Akinge was one of those smart fundamentalists, non-Reformed, who went to Princeton and studied with Machen. And so Machen dies in January 1st, 1937. So it's speculation on what he would have made of all that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's fairly clear from his own track record that he thought that indifferentism to denominational distinctives was a mistake. He admired the Christian Reformed Church throughout his life because they held on to their catechisms. They taught their kids in Christian schools. Same thing he admired the Missouri Synod of Lutheran Church. So I think it's fair to say that Machen wasn't interested in a broad pan-Protestant effort. He was interested in the Reformed faith and establishing a church and Reformed institutions. And that's clearly the way the leadership of the OPC understood it in the late 30s and early 1940s. Which is why they wouldn't go along with this pan-Protestant lowest common denominator mm-hmm. effort to try to get all conservative Protestants under one umbrella to fight the Federal Council of Churches. That was something you could do, but it was going to be a way you did it through your own denomination. Mm-hmm. Sort of like a version of states' rights versus the national government. This was like denominations' rights. We're going to do it through our denomination. We'll oppose liberalism there, and we're not going to follow this road of some large national consolidated structure, which oftentimes does go off the rails. Federal Council did, the National mm-hmm. Association, you could argue, did, the federal government did. So,
were the Lutheran and Reformed churches impacted at all? Surely they had to have been.
Ever since the 1940s, the churches that have stayed out of the National Association have been regarded as sectarian.
Yes.
So Lutherans are haunted by that. Christian Reformed churches has been haunted. The OPC has been haunted by it. And so people have had to sort of figure out why we don't cooperate, yet how we still can be ecumenical.
Yeah.
And there are different avenues for being ecumenical. But this also goes back. I mean, there was a similar set of debates in the 19th century at the time of the New School Old School controversy, where there was something called the Benevolent Empire, which was all these interdenominational or parachurch organizations, tract societies, Bible societies, mission societies, publications societies of various kinds, and a number of Protestants were cooperating in those because they were trying to create a Christian America, and the New School Presbyterians were very much involved and invested in those agents, those parachurch right. organizations. The Old Schoolers said, this isn't Presbyterian, this isn't the way to do Presbyterianism. So part of the Old School, New School division of 1837, 1838 was over this, whether you're going to be a Presbyterian or whether you're going to participate in parachurch, mm-hmm. broadly evangelical organizations.
A large part of your book is taken up with the issue of inerrancy as that unifying, almost isolated doctrinal standard for quote-unquote evangelicals. And you make the point several times that the infallibility versus inerrancy issue, where almost inerrancy is not mentioned explicitly, but infallibility is mentioned, the scripture being the infallible rule. And then after the 1940s and 50s into the 70s, Boyce and some other men start the ICBI, the Council of Biblical Inerrancy. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty important council. I mean, these men believed if you give up inerrancy, you give up everything. And yet inerrancy, I think your argument is it's not enough. I mean, I know that's your
right.
argument. How do we sift through that and balance that? Because if inerrancy is the core foundational, if you give up inerrancy, you give up everything, and yet it's not enough. What would you say to people who might listen to this that are wrestling with how you can be united with others, how you can be connected with other denominations, other biblical denominations, and yet that not being enough? Sorry if that's not
well.
Very
I mean,
clear.
The way to make it concrete, your question concrete is, I mean, as an Orthodox Presbyterian, I subscribe Westminster Standard. So the first chapter of the Westminster Confession, I think, is as good a creedal statement of the doctrine of Scripture as there is in the 16th to 17th centuries. It's way longer than the one sentence assertion of inerrancy that the National Association has. And so, you know, but there are 32 other chapters, or is it 30? How many chapters in the Confession?
33, I think.
Yeah. So the 32 other chapters. And so it's not, I mean, those are important too. So if someone's going to cooperate with me or the OPC, they sort of have to go through a lot of other theology
to get
there. That
is essential doctrine, the Confession is.
Well, it's...
In this ecclesiastical body, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and so inerrancy... I mean, the way George Marsden even put it at one point when he was writing on these matters is that inerrancy itself doesn't resolve what the Bible actually teaches inerrantly.
Right. You could be a heretic
right.
and hold to inerrancy.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so there's a lot more you have to go through. So a high regard for Scripture is a really good thing. Mm-hmm. And even this recently, CT ran a story about the Vatican doing, holding a new synod for the bishops to talk about what yeah. inerrancy means for Roman Catholics, and maybe backing away from some of the statements made at Vatican II. So, you know, this isn't just a going all the way back to the Rogers McKim book of 1979, who argued that the Princeton Doctrine of Inerrancy was a novelty and it's not, you know, it was another version of the Calvin against the Calvinist. So Warfield and these guys came up with this doctrine that Calvin didn't know, and I really think that evangelicalism did go off the rails in the late 70s, early 80s over the debates on inerrancy. That had been the doctrine that sort of kept everybody together. ETS, you had to affirm it to be even a member of ETS. So in some ways it worked, but in some ways it was hollow, as it showed, I think, late 1970s. And there was no doctrine of the church to go with it. There was no doctrine of the organizations that would enforce this, in effect.
Just to tail on that, sorry, Jeff. One thing you've mentioned before, just in other conversations, just ways that other groups are trying to draw the line. And it's a really tough question, where you draw the doctrinal line on fellowship, on cooperation. And you've mentioned before groups like the Gospel Coalition and Together for the Gospel, who seem to be trying to draw that line on, is it a matter of the gospel? But then you can move that boundary around too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a really difficult question. That's the
way some people try to build fences and, you know, is broadly Calvinistic, you know, enough to unite? And these are difficult questions.
And what does uniting mean too? I mean, that's right. Another.
Yeah, I mean, what it really is. If you're doing it. Typically the way you use for fellowship or fraternity, the language that language is the ultimate expression of that is to have free and open pulpit exchange, so that somebody who preaches in this denomination can preach in this. But oftentimes, what people mean by fellowship is just sort of
it doesn't matter.
Where it's a warm, fuzzy feeling that I have. You know, we have fellowship because.
We
like
together.
Each other. I mean, or we affirm. So it's more a sense of affinity than it is an actual sense of membership or belonging to a moral community where there are real obligations, duties, and there are real authorities that can enforce these obligations and duties.
Mm-hmm. I just had a couple of questions, and they may not relate. The first is there really such a thing as an evangelical? And two, what is the evangelical doctrine of the church?
And we'll take up the rest of our time with this, too.
Well, I mean, I tried to argue in the book that there was no such thing as an evangelical, that it's simply a construction. And it is a plastic term that people can have filled in a variety of ways with different meanings. So in that sense, I think it doesn't exist the way people imagine it does. But there are lots of people who, I mean, self-identifying yourself as an evangelical counts for something. It also suggests to me that there aren't other labels that people can use to identify themselves. So I guess if there is a kind of born-again, mere Christianity, evangelicalism would be it. But it's trying to identify it, to use that bad cliche, is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It's just very difficult. And so for that reason, I still think something, I don't know if there's a better word to describe trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. I mean, so it'd be better for evangelicals to be something more than what they are then, and not to be so squishy.
Before you get to the question of the church, not to totally derail that, but just following up on that thought, do you think it has become, at least for the nation, not for the Christians, but for the nation, do you think the word evangelical has just become a political term?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's why increasingly college students don't like to use it to designate themselves, because it is associated with the religious right. It's associated with George Bush. It's associated with a very unpopular war. And so the religious right is a whole nother layer on top of the various meanings of evangelicalism, which is why the Evangelical Manifesto, which came out maybe 6-7 months ago, spearheaded in part by people like Timothy George at Beeson Divinity School, Richard Mao, and others, are saying, we're evangelical, but we're not that kind of evangelical. They're trying to recover what real evangelical is, but it just, it seems to me it's just one more instance of evangelicals reinventing themselves.
Yeah.
Now, as far as the church, the doctrine of the church of evangelicalism, I would say it either doesn't have one, or if it does have one, it's all about the invisible church. That, and that's pretty much all it is. So wherever the Spirit works, that's where the church is. And who can know it?
Yeah.
I mean, and so all the efforts of the institutional church to embody it, I mean, you can have people who can value that or maybe be critical of it. You can have various degrees on the spectrum, but nobody is really kind of bound by it and committed to it, that this is the institution with the ministry and means that God has ordained to establish his people. So that one isn't there, unfortunately.
Well, what's fascinating to me is that they don't trust a visible church, but they have no trouble with visible bureaucracies of other types.
Oh, exactly.
So they've done is replaced what is God's ordained means,
right?
Church with organizations and hierarchies that have no such promise.
And so the real church or the real hierarchy for evangelicalism could be the Evangelical Council on Financial Accountability.
Or yeah, that's
cool.
I mean, those are the people that sort of give you the bona fides to say you're legitimate. You're not this Elmer Gantry trying to steal.
Yeah.
Or fleece the flock. Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned this almost preoccupation with the invisible church and who can know it, George Barna. It seems, I'm sorry, you had a chapter on this. And I wanted to ask you a question. It seems like to have a best-selling book, a best-selling Christian book, you have to include figures by George Barna, or at least a Gallup poll.
Right.
Yes.
When did this fascination with statistics come in, and what's going on here? When did the church decide that we need to be statistical?
Well, I think you could... Again, I think it's the politics. I mean, polling had been going on, as I seem to recall in some of the reading I did a while ago, maybe back to the early 20th century. Mm-hmm. And it was always usually done by political campaigns and often by advertisers. And I think in the 70s, when the political parties realized that there was this vast group of Christians that could be brought into especially the Republican Party, I think that's when people went out and started to try to poll among them more. And Christianity Today did an important poll of its own readers by Gallup in, I think, roughly 1979, which was the year that Moral Majority was founded, a year before Reagan. So in some ways you had this kind of harmonic convergence of polling and evangelicalism and the religious right and Reagan that made it all go together, and I'm not sure where Barna emerged from all that, but I mean, he's sort of the bad cop. Gallup is the good cop. Evangelicalism is fine. It's going well, and then Barna's the bad cop, and evangelicals going to hell in a handbasket.
It's also illustrative, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that sometimes he lumps in Mormons with some of his Christian numbers and other types of things, too. I mean, it just goes to show the broadening and this lower its common denominator type mentality. And it almost seems like the citizens, evangelicals, just like to see those numbers and want to see them so high. And when they see that they're, you know, that our nation, 70-some percent of them believe in a God or something like that, that gives people some comfort or hope.
Right.
But then when there's no content to that actual number,
right?
You know, what does it mean to believe in a God? Well, these people have no confession. They're just answering a question on a poll. It doesn't really carry with it any weight. It's a false sense.
No, exactly. Right.
But why do you think so many Americans feel compelled to say they're Christians when they're obviously not? I mean, there are so many that would not even affirm inerrancy, would not affirm. How has this broad umbrella of evangelicalism affected the common American? Because, I mean, I know this gets into the whole, are we a Christian nation?
Right.
Should we be? But, I mean, evangelicalism's had a massive effect on this country.
Well, I would say, one, it's you can answer those polling questions in the affirmative about your being a Christian, going to church. And, you know, I guess 40% of Americans or something say they go to church. It turns out that maybe if truth is told, they're lying, that it's only 20%. You know, and
which tells us something, the need to lie.
Right.
That tells us something, too.
But, I mean, you can say pretty much anything to those, and you can sort of portray yourself as being this good person. I really think that's a big part of it. People, there's nothing to be lost by saying that you believe in God, that you believe the Bible, and those sorts of answers to polling questions. And one of the most important books written on American Christianity is Nathan Hatch's The Democratization of American Christianity, published in 1989. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and probably should have won it. But it's an amazing book, and it's about the early 19th century. And he basically argues how Christianity, especially Protestantism, became sort of the popular faith in America. And so there's a built-in cultural tradition of affirming God, affirming belief in Christianity and things like that. And to be an atheist or to be a secularist is really to sort of be fighting the trend, even though the university world or higher education or elite media, intellectual sorts of journals that's not the case. But just with Joe the plumber and people like that,
right?
It's just the popular way to be. And up through the 1960s, because of the so-called Protestant establishment, the American way of life was considered to be the Protestant way of life. Roman Catholics were outsiders because they weren't Protestants and they weren't good Americans. So that there was this real fusion.
Until JFK, probably.
Even beyond.
After,
it's really after Vatican II. And I would argue that it's John Paul II that really changes the face of the Vatican. Mm. But so it's just this built-in, all these American sorts of cultural assumptions about Christianity that make it very easy for people, especially Protestants, to affirm it, or people with some kind of Protestant affiliation.
If we shift gears a little bit, you've written a book called With Reverence and Awe, and let's talk a little bit about evangelical worship. Do they have a particular doctrine of worship or thoughts about worship, or is it a lot looser than that? Is it anything goes? And how do evangelicals typically order their worship, and where do they take their cues from?
I think the main impulse guiding evangelical worship is to produce an experience in the worshiper. Mm-hmm. I think that goes all the way back to the revivals, at least of the 18th century. I don't mean to blame everything on revivalism, even though I generally do. But I grew up in that environment. But I also go to an OP church now where I think people sort of sense it, you know, it may not be the feeling that they want, but they want intellectual content to come be rewarded, to be the reward of going to church. So there's got to be something for me.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable that Calvinists don't have a sense that, wait, there's just something, we've got to pay homage to God here.
Yeah.
We got a whole day to do it. Every week, that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so just doing that is a big part of worship. And then if you get something out of it, that's like gravy, you know?
Right.
That's interesting.
But, I mean,
that's the way God has made us as well, as we worship. That's
right, as we, I mean, we actually get something out of worshiping, especially worshiping him.
Exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But most people want that experience in the American church without much work, without much effort. They want it to come as easily as it can come.
Or in the way they want
with that.
It.
And that's why, I mean, the Reformed Church, yes, there can be a self-gratifying.
But isn't standing for a half hour singing different up-tempo songs pretty challenging?
If they make you cry.
I mean, because one of the best books on worship I read, I don't remember the name of it, but Don Husted, who was a great Southern Baptist student of hymnody and worked on a variety of Southern Baptist hymnals, I hope I'm getting that right. And in the Southern Baptist world, hymnody and special music is a big deal. I mean, they have whole schools of music at their seminary. So, I mean, so Don Husted is a big deal. And he was saying that basically there's a Pentecostal charismatic understanding of worship, which I think is more and more true for evangelical worship at large, which is that people, by experience, by getting, having more and more of an experience in worship, that is when God becomes present, is in their experience. When they reach a certain threshold, then God is present. And so that's why you, in so many praise and worship settings, you have this half hour of song, which is supposed to work everybody up, to get them to an emotional pitch where God is present, which is totally different from Reform worship, where at the very beginning we invoke the presence of God. And at that point, we're there. We've been raised up into glory with the saints and angels, and God is there, whether we know it or not.
That's right.
And so there's this objective element to Reform that I would also argue Lutheran and probably Anglican worship to historic Protestant worship. There's an objective element that is something's going on there, whether or not you're feeling it or experiencing it. But I would say that evangelicalism, back to your question, Camden, is very much geared toward that experience, and that's when it's meaningful, is if the worshipers are moved. And, you know, the height of that, of course, at one time was the altar call, and that's when people really were moved. They were moved to get up and move down the aisle.
Mm-hmm. When did the shift towards contemporary styles of music come in? I've heard some people claim it was back with people like, you know, Sister Amy Semple McPherson, or where the actual contemporary styles of the day started to come into the church. Or do you think it was just that desire for the experience? It was the time. It was the desire. You know, they wanted the music that they enjoyed, so they started to incorporate contemporary worship or contemporary music.
My sense, I guess, and I think Sister Amy is interesting there, is that Pentecostal forms of worship were much more like that, much more up-tempo in style all the way before the rise of the Jesus music or Jesus rock. And it was Jesus rock in the 70s that made up-tempo stuff acceptable for the uptight Baptists and Presbyterians. But prior to that, charismatic and Pentecostal worship had been much more experiential, but it would have been more country. I mean, you can go on cable.
Yeah, the gospel's
music. Yeah, and you hear this gospel sort of music, and it's not Larry Norman, it's not Petra, it's not Second Chapter of Acts or whatever.
Striper.
Yeah.
But, you
That's
know,
our Steve Nichols.
So it's the boomers, my generation, that sort of gets on board with Christian rock. Mm-hmm. Or Christian rock light, or Christian light rock, that then comes into the churches in contemporary worship, and then in the 70s and 80s you have more of a fusion of charismatic and Pentecostal and this Christian rock music that then typifies contemporary worship. I mean, I was in Grand Rapids a couple months ago, and I went to one of the emergent churches. I guess one of the most important emergent churches it wasn't a worship service, they call it a gathering, and it was Rob Bell's church.
Really?
and it was the most seeker unfriendly service I've been to, because there was nobody leading the service. I showed
Hence
up
the gathering,
and I was just supposed to know what was going on, and the band started at about 6, and they just went on. Occasionally one of the song leaders would say something about introducing a new song, but nobody said, "Welcome, how you doing? Glad to have you here. Visitors, raise your hands. We're going to send out some cards down the aisles," or whatever, you know, or, you know, "Make sure you sign up at the back because we really want you to be." No, it was for this gathering, and if you were an outsider,
Rob Bell should listen to this interview.
I mean, people at the church were, people were friendly. It wasn't as if they said, "Get away from me."
Yeah.
But it wasn't as if I knew what was going on. There was no bulletin. There was no, and the order
of liturgy.
There was an order of service. It was a half hour of song and then a long talk.
Mm-hmm.
which is what you basically get, you know, in most P&W or megachurch services. So the emergent, which is supposed to be, you know, contrary to the megachurch, it follows the same form. Okay, the music was different. They had a bigger, much bigger percussion section in the band, so big that they had to have it, like, sunk in the stage and surrounded by with this plastic area so it didn't the drums didn't dominate, but...
But there was a form, a definite structure. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, and it seems as though nowadays, in many ways, for the broader evangelical church, that the music style, the music is how you grade a church, really. That's the way to say if this is a good church or not. And actually, there's even an identification in many ways of worship with music. Well, this has been an excellent interview, Dr. Hart. We appreciate you coming over and making the time for us. I'd like to point everyone back, of course, to the many books that Dr. Hart has written. He's also co-written some with John Meether that I haven't mentioned, including Seeking a Better Country, 300 Years of American Presbyterianism. If you'd like to get more information about us, you can visit the website at reformedforum.org. You can visit the contact page if you'd like to get a hold of us. If you have any questions or any comments about our programs, you can find them there. We'd like to thank everyone for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.